As a business owner, it's important to keep your business connected. Spectrum Business is committed to keeping your business online whenever and wherever you need us, all backed by the Spectrum Commitment. Get fast, reliable internet starting at $40 per month when bundled, or level up your internet speed and get a 3-year price guarantee. Learn how Spectrum Business can help your business stay connected at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Some people follow the rules, but where's the fun in that? I'm Soraya, and this is Rule Breakers, the podcast where we celebrate the rebels, the risk takers, and the ones who make their own way. Every week, I sit down with the boldest voices in sports, entertainment, and beyond to talk about breaking barriers, defying expectations, and rewriting the rules. No limits, no apologies, just real talk. Follow and listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
The Masonic Temple is one of the most legendary buildings in Detroit.
But is it one of the most haunted?
I mean, if you feel as though that you're going to be uncomfortable in this building and you kind of carry in that way, then you're probably going to be uncomfortable.
Maybe the Masonic Temple is only haunted because you think it is. This is The Daily J. I'm Zach Clark.
And I'm Annie Scarmazzino.
Annie, first can I say how good it is to be back? Like, we are back.
Heck yeah, finally.
And we sound a little different, probably.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, our environment is a heck of a lot different than it normally is.
We've been circling this story for years throughout our Spooky J series. You know, we've done 12 of these, I think, or something like that. The Masonic Temple always seemed way too daunting of a task. I mean, it's just an enormous building with immense history that means so much to the city. We just felt like there was no way to do it. Right, it'd be like trying to shorten War and Peace. Right, like how does one do something like that? But not only do we tackle the episode, Annie, we're in lodge room number 5 on the 5th floor right now.
We're on location, on site. We've never done one quite like this before for a lot of different reasons. Every year we put together our list of hopeful stories and places, and you know, we always included the Masonic Temple on there. And then every single year we were like, I don't think we can do it justice. There's just so much information here. It's dense in the best way possible. And we didn't want to kind of halfway do it. So this year, because of the way things were looking, we thought we actually have the time to be able to dedicate to this story. And so we jumped on it.
Yeah. And you know, one of the first things folks think about, and it's probably the part we're going to talk about the least, because I think it's what people know about the most, is the music, right? This is a multi-venued music mecca, which when you listen to the history from award-winning music critic Gary Graff, it makes a lot of sense.
You had the Rolling Stones play there. They did a special show there. It wasn't in town at the time, but if I recall what I heard right, you know, it was announced like that day or the day before. It was one of these surprise shows. The Who, you know, when they were filling stadiums, played a show at the Masonic. This was the House of Prince. He played like a half dozen shows during the 1999 tour there before he moved to arena size, then came back in 1986 to play a show during his birthday weekend. It was just magnificent. Stevie Wonder filmed the Showtime special playing at the Masonic. You know, you had some great gigs there by the White Stripes. Grizz, you know, that was the culminating shows on the weekend of Grizzmas were always done at the Masonic. They really do have a who's who of superstars who have played in that room. This is where Detroit first saw the Phantom of the Opera and where Disney brought Beauty and the Beast and so many other productions. So it really is striking how many things can and have happened.
We were standing on the stage in one of the theaters and we asked, you know, if there were reoccurring type shows they saw most often. And the chief docent told us that the venues are great for EDM. And I got to say, Gary, that surprised me just because when the building was built, EDM was still, I don't know, 80 years away.
Sure, but you know, there is something about the whole Masonic vibe. EDM and dance parties are great in unique locations. They thrive on that. And you've got all these unique spaces in the Masonic, whether it's Grizz playing in the main room or somebody playing downstairs. They're just very unique environments to have an EDM type of show. That's been proven. They get a pretty healthy dose of the touring EDM acts. You know, it kind of goes in a pattern here in Detroit. They start at like a Basement or something, but then they work their way to the Magic Stick or Electricity, and then they're at the Majestic, and then it seems like the Masonic is that next step for the DJs on their way to the arenas and the stadium.
We know this, Annie, the Masonic is much more than a venue, right? I mean, you couldn't have 1,037 venues. This building has 1,037 rooms. And our most gracious host, who happens to be with us this evening, walked us all over the place, right? It was like 2 hours. It was definitely the longest interview tour we've had.
Yeah, we got our steps in that day for sure. And I've been in the Masonic Temple more times than I could probably count. But like you were saying, Zach, it was mostly always for a concert at one of the two music venues here. So to be able to get a look behind the scenes at all of the other spaces that are being used all the time, which again is something I didn't really realize, just like how much of the building is activated constantly on a day-to-day basis. And so that was an amazing thing to be able to do. And Rob treated us to the two-hour tour, and we were lucky to be able to do it.
Rob Moore is the Masonic Temple's chief docent and the executive director of the Detroit Masonic Temple Library, Archive, and Research Center. And I love how he said his predecessor would give like eight-hour tours, which, I mean, again, of a building this size, you could easily see how that could happen.
The building is still actively owned and operated by the Masons of Detroit, the Detroit Masonic Temple Association. They've been around since 1894. So they are the owner-operator entity for the building. So we're still independently owned, independently operated. The Masons of Detroit still call this place home. We've got a total of 15 active Masonic organizations that meet here. Some meet monthly.
You and I laugh too, because we're kind of like the perfect audience for this sort of thing. We are so interested in... kind of everything.
Tell me everything.
So, you know, we could have walked around for easily another like 6 hours and never have gotten bored. And, you know, every single aspect, all the stories, all the history of the architecture, the history of the Freemasons, all of that stuff. I mean, that was, all of it was compelling to us.
I'm so glad you said that. It's a great segue, because like before we go any further, I feel like we have to talk about the elevator. We got to ride it again coming up. And it's just one of those things, like the Masonic Temple is cool for a million reasons, but I didn't have on my bingo card, as the kids say, the elevator being one of them. Because when you go to the music venues, you don't have to go that far up. It's there, you walk into them, right? And so it was this, and Rob's going to explain it for us, but it's this amazing, like, hand-operated elevator. It was just one of the coolest things I've ever experienced, and it was totally not expected.
Yeah, it's pretty funny too. If you listen in to your recording of that, you can hear me go like, whoa, in the background. And so you can tell I was really impressed by it, because otherwise, you know, I couldn't stop myself.
This is one of our original 1925 manually operated Otis elevators. We have a total of 12 elevators in the building. This one, along with the other one, is installed in 1925 by the Otis Elevator Company. Not the oldest elevators in Detroit, but going by the serial number, among the oldest actively used elevators in the city right here. So this gate is pneumatically operated. So what that means is that I push this knob right here forward. Okay, once both gates shut, we're good to go. That hissing you hear is the air coming down the shaft. Then I crank it like this. Go down a little bit. Yeah, a little bit of a jolt. Then we go one. This will be a short trip. And the tricky part is lining this up, and you can either, I go by sight, by the door right here. Some people use the tape.
You have to do that manually?
Yep. I'm 100% in control of this right now. So, here we go. That was so cool.
That's the coolest elevator I've ever been on.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? There's a scene where they're in an elevator, and it reminded me exactly of that.
We're going to have more on some of that stuff later, because like the elevator is just one of several contraptions we came across. I mean, even the lights were complicated, like turning them on and off. But, you know, the Masonic Temple, as we've talked about, it is gargantuan.
So the building itself is a total of 17 floors, 210 feet tall. The building itself is 550,000 square feet. So, I mean, it takes up, I mean, from the outside, pretty much an entire city block. It still is the largest Masonic building in the world. Until 1943, when the Pentagon was built, we had the world's record for length of tunnels and hallways as well. At one time, back when we had a full-size kitchen, we had 5 executive dining rooms down the hall right here. If you staggered them right, you could feed up to 5,000 people simultaneously. We had 63,000 Masons using this building at the time in the 1920s. Now, this room's full name is the Commandery Asylum. We're on the 3rd floor. The ceiling extends all the way to the 4th floor mezzanine. So this is a very tall room.
So we were on this tour for 2 hours, but I mean, I imagine we probably didn't even come close to seeing all there is to see in this building. I don't know how long of a tour you would have to do to see every single square inch of this building. I can't imagine if anybody could even estimate it. Could you, Rob?
It would take you about 9 days for a 10-hour day.
So that's 90 hours. 90. So that means the 8-hour tour that we talked about is not even 10%.
That's insane. I mean, I couldn't even compare that to something else that would take that long to explore. I feel like you could see like a full island in that amount of time.
I mean, that's 2 work weeks for your average person. That's a paycheck spent trying to wander one building. And, you know, of a building this size, I guess it kind of makes sense. But one of the things that gets me is how many different architecture styles there are throughout the Masonic, right? And I'm no architecture expert. We've done a lot of episodes about Detroit buildings, and usually they stick to a theme. And this one is all of it all at once. It made my head spin.
There's a lot of architectural variety within the Detroit Masonic Temple, but its overall exterior design is neo-Gothic. So it's designed to resemble a large castle, a large cathedral for the exterior.
Because the Corinthian style of architecture is considered to be the most elaborate, the most detailed, the most ornate, this lodge room kind of follows suit. I mean, this one's a bit brighter than most of the other lodge rooms. This one's a bit more detailed as far as that goes.
So this one is designed after the Temple of Aphrodite at Corinth.
So this entire area, the building right here, kind of has like more of a medieval look and feel to it.
This room is the prelate's apartment. It's one of 2 rooms with a Romanesque architectural style.
So this room is the Tudor lodge room.
T-U-D-O-R.
Yeah, the House of Tudor.
Yep. This one is designed not so much after like a building from ancient Greece or ancient Rome. This one is designed after the Tudor time period in England. The interesting portion about this theater is that this is designed in the Venetian Gothic style. This one is specifically designed to resemble like an opera house from Paris.
Yeah, it was very cool. I mean, every time we walked into another lodge room, it had a different aesthetic, a different style. It reminded me quite a bit of when I went to Michigan State. I worked at the president's house there, Cole's house, and all of the bedrooms there are decorated in a very specific way. And it's the same thing as the Grand Hotel in Mackinac Island that we've covered in the past. And they have everything sort of decorated and painted very specifically room to room. And a lot of Masonic and the different like lodge rooms reminded me of that, of the different like thoughtfulness that they put into decorating, designing, and the execution
Look up.
Of different rooms. Oh, I know, it's stunning. And again, it's a podcast and we're very aware that it's hard to do it justice. And trust me, we did plenty of video and photos for social media, and you can check that out later on WWJ's social media pages. But I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful. There's so much to see. It really is just like art everywhere you look.
And what I think is so amazing too, is you talk about a building, it's 500,000 square feet and it was built 100 years ago. And you see some of the walls where the room we're sitting in does not have these walls, but the whole wall is hand carved wood. There's no laser, there's no CAD, nothing. You wouldn't be able to look at a rendering, a smaller one, a bigger one. You could probably draw it out, but you couldn't try it out first.
I think that's what's so impressive to me about architecture that happened in this era, is that you had to have equal parts of an artistic brain and an engineering brain, right? Like you needed to be able to execute this kind of a thing in a safe way while still having a vision for how beautiful or, you know, however you wanted the building to look. Nowadays, sort of half of that can be done with a computer. So it, to me, that makes it just even more impressive, especially the scale of this place.
I mean, you're going to hear Annie and I faint a little bit later walking into the cathedral. But I remember Rob telling us, though, one of the rooms, the Tudor room, we were talking about things being hand-carved, right? And so at that time, it would have taken forever to get the wood shavings down. None of these Masonic rooms have a window in them, but that one does. It was designed specifically to be able to get that wood shaving out. So exactly what you're talking about, it's form and function, and somehow it comes out gorgeous.
It just takes an immense amount of planning and forethought, and to me, that is just so impressive. The amount of time that it must have taken to just like plan all of this out. I just don't think that things like that happen in this day and age. And honestly, buildings of this size and scale for in this like sort of multi-use space, I can't think of anything that's created recently and built recently, especially in the city. I mean, we're getting a lot of buildings with condos and new
Hudson's all glass.
Yeah, new skyscrapers, but nothing like this. And it just blows my mind that, you know, people did this, that this took people actually like planning it out and building it and creating it. And we're still enjoying it all these years later. The Daily J continues after this.
There are two men responsible for this building, at least of its creation and execution. And both of those names are familiar to those who study Detroit architecture.
This is a very detail-oriented building. Nothing was left to chance. It was very meticulously designed. George D. Mason was the building architect. You can still see some of his surviving works all throughout the city. Corrado Parducci was the interior designer, the building artisan. And again, another household name in the Detroit architectural scene. Many of his surviving works, just to name a couple examples, the Fisher Building, the Guardian Building, many others. But this was Parducci's first big break. He started on this building when he was 23 years old. His services were recommended by Albert Kahn. That's one of the myths running this building. This building was designed by Albert Kahn. That's not true. There are a couple Kahn buildings nearby, but George D. Mason was the architect of record. Mason and Kahn worked with each other for a while. Mason was known for many years as the Dean of Detroit Architects. Many of his proteges, including Kahn, went on to do great things, but this was a George D. Mason designed building, and Kahn recommended the services of Corrado Parducci, and the rest was history.
Andy, when you walk around and you look at the foresight you'd have to have to design and build, and then the little push and pull between Mason and Parducci. Like, the whole thing is just fabulously interesting to me.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I love Detroit stories where you get these sort of like key players, these common denominator names that are familiar, you know, otherwise too. And so it kind of like resonates with the rest of the city. It makes it relevant to not just this space, but across the city of Detroit.
Yeah, I remember we did that Charles Lindbergh story, and his mother was a lodge, right? That's how I got here today.
Yeah.
On the lodge.
I know
that
name. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, Detroit has a history, Andy, stretching back over 300 years. And, you know, we've gone over, I feel like, almost all of it at this point throughout 600 episodes of this podcast. But the Masons have been witness to almost all of that history.
So Masonry is the second oldest organization in the city of Detroit. We got our start back in 1764. The only thing older than us in the city is St. Anne's Basilica. Back when this was still Fort Detroit, a group of British Army officers happened to be Masons. And keeping in mind at that time, this was largely wilderness, with the exception of Detroit, Fort Michilimackinac, which is Mackinac, a couple outposts. Pretty much everything in that was just vast, vast wilderness. Detroit was a very different place at that time, but it's taken on several different forms, different guises, but Michigan Masonry goes all the way back to 1764, so we've been involved with the city and the state of Michigan that long. It wasn't until the early 1890s that they actually built a purpose-built Masonic temple for the most part. We had, obviously, some buildings prior to that. At the time, there were 11 Masonic organizations in the city. They pooled together their resources to build a building. That building is currently where the Comerica Building is at First and Lafayette. That building was designed for 50 years of use by the Freemasons of Detroit. However, membership was growing so fast at the time, they ran out of room in about a dozen years. So they decided in about 1913 to build a much larger building somewhere in the city. Now, they did a very exhaustive site search. That took several years. It wasn't until 1919 that they settled on this particular property right here. They didn't want us to have the same problem. They didn't want to run out of room again. So they kind of built a much, much, much larger building here to accommodate future growth as well.
We read there was a shovel used to lay the front cornerstone of this building that George Washington used in building the U.S. Capitol, I believe.
Yeah, in fact, September 18th, 1922 is when the cornerstone for the building was laid. Part of the reason that they did that was because that same date in 1793 is when George Washington laid the cornerstone for the United States Capitol. The same trowel that he used in that ceremony was used in this ceremony. And then 2 years ago, for 100th anniversary, it came back.
And he was a Mason, right?
George Washington, yes. George Washington was a Mason. We have a few likenesses of all throughout the building. Our first president was a Freemason.
And when you think about that, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah. And again, the key players, the notable people throughout history. I mean, these are names that we know very famously in Detroit, and they played a key part in the city, of course. And the networking and the things that went on with these types of people, these key players, I think that that's fascinating.
Well, I mean, that's a good way to put it, too, because, I mean, the Masonic mission is one thing, but the amount of power broking that would have happened here at that time would have been, and probably still does. I'm not saying it doesn't anymore, but Henry Ford is no longer with us, so there's not quite that resonance. And I'm glad that you mentioned the people and the players, because as almost everybody knows, the Masonic Temple fell on some hard times, as did almost everything else in this city. But enter a hero, a Detroit rock god. I think one of the things that people remember about this building or think about is Jack White. Can you go through how that happened?
So long story short, back in the mid-2010s, there was an operation agreement at the time. That operation agreement didn't go as well as we'd hoped. It ended. We did have some outstanding bills. One of them was the property taxes. We did have a plan in place to pay that off. We had a payment plan in place. Unfortunately, it hit the papers and it wasn't quite 100% accurate in terms of what was reported. So then what happened is that Jack White just showed up at the back desk and said, you know, hey, I heard about what's happening and I'd like to help. So he just made a very generous, unsolicited donation. Then the rest is history. We were very thankful for that. It was a very generous kind of support for the building.
We talk about Jack White a lot and his like eccentricities because he's just such a fascinating person. I can imagine it happening exactly like that. He just kind of strolls in, writes a check and then walks out. I mean, is that basically what happened?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, the idea was is that the building helped his family out in time of need, so he kind of wanted to return the favor.
I'm glad you said what you did because I thought that he saved the building, but you could have saved it too, is how that story goes, right? People don't say the second part.
Yeah. I mean, we would have been okay, but obviously if we had that kind of help, we were going to take it. So we were very thankful and very appreciative of that donation.
Yeah, you're okayer after the donation.
Yeah. When Jack donated the money, he didn't want to make a big deal out of it. He actually said, like, you know, please don't name anything after me or anything like that. But at the time, we were so excited, we went ahead and named the lobby and the theater in his honor. And then in 2019, because Jack White's not a part of the AEG family, and because there's actually a superstition of naming a theater after a living person, they respectfully just asked that we refer to this as the Cathedral Theater and the Cathedral Lobby. We're abiding by that.
And so, I'm sure Jack White's much happier.
Yeah, yeah. Like you're saying, like he was trying to keep things low key. He wasn't trying to make it about him.
Right.
Yeah.
I found that last part, Annie, so interesting. And again, it's why we do these shows. So often folks only hear or remember like the biggest, most exciting part. Maybe that's all they were ever told. I don't ever remember hearing, oh, we could have helped ourselves, but Jack White jumped in anyway. I was just told either he does this or we raise the building.
Well, right. And it's the headlines, right? We work in news. We understand how this happens. How many times have we reported in depth on a story for only people to kind of like spit back the key phrases at us and say, no, that's not the whole story. If you read the whole article, then you'll see that this was how it actually went. But Jack White has a pretty storied history with this location. Everybody knows he's tied pretty tightly to the Cass Corridor in general. And I believe that his mom was an usher here at the Masonic Temple. That was one thing that I didn't know going into it. And I'm a big Jack White fan. Everybody that knows me knows that.
For him to be able to not only be instrumental in preserving the building, but then come back here and do one of the most Jack White things ever and propose and marry his girlfriend on the same show right on stage, right? I mean, that's Detroit lore. It's history. That'll go down forever.
Oh, yeah. And I love, like, any Detroiter has their favorite spots in the city. We all do, of course. And it's really cool that it's very clear that this is one of Jack White's favorite spots. When he comes and he plays, he could play anywhere, realistically. But he always makes it a point to play here. And I think that that's really great.
And the Masonic has a new operating agreement, by the way. And you heard Rob mention it. The company's called AEG. And Gary, our music critic, he agrees that it works out really well.
The AEG has found a home that it needed in the market. And the Masonic found a dedicated promoter. You know, much like, you know, 313 Presents, it is mostly, you know, they host AEG concerts as well, but most of their shows come from Live Nation. And AEG was in need of a home in this market, and the Masonic gives them a good home.
And thank goodness it worked out the way that it did. I mean, could you imagine losing this building? Could you imagine losing rooms like the chapel?
Wow. This is unbelievable. I have goosebumps right now.
I'm such a sucker for like stained glass too, and that's stunning.
And look at the cross.
More of the Daily J is next. So there was one question that you and I both had going into this tour, and I think it's something that gets talked about a lot. Does the Masonic Temple have hidden passageways? No, but it does have passageways and then some.
Yeah, no, Rob was showing us around and showing us kind of like the function of the passageways. And it's not exactly what you would think of when you'd think of a secret passageway. It's more for function.
We do have like a lot of infrastructure to the building. That's why we have a lot of these larger tunnels and passageways for the maintenance crew to do what they need to do to maintain the building. I mean, there's areas that are designed so that they're not interfering with areas used by the public or by Masons.
Not all the rooms have them. This one does. This is an area called the Tyler's Passage. Now, The Tyler, T-I-L-E-R, is the Masonic officer whose job is to guard the door while the meetings are in session. You know, make sure everybody coming in and coming out is, you know, okay to do so. So we have certain Tyler's passages right here. So this is designed if, like, he has to take care of something while the meeting is in session, because while the lodge is in session, we try to keep interruptions to a minimum. I mean, we don't want a lot of banging and crashing, doors opening and stuff like that. It's kind of like a temporary refuge from the outside world. So we kind of keep that in mind. So if he has to take care of something, he can walk around it. Or if, like, a member has to, you know, use the restroom, take a phone call or something like that, he can go out that door and come around this way and just kind of go back in and whatnot.
It's more of like kind of a way around the building than it is to creep through the underground. There's no catacombs. I don't know. Maybe there are catacombs in the basement. I can't say for sure, but
the passageways are just one of the things that sparked such a curiosity in the building. And I asked Rob, like, what at the core is it that makes people so curious?
There's this draw that people are just like a dog, kind of head sideways.
A lot of it is that people like are kind of attracted to what they don't know and they don't understand. So there's that natural element of human curiosity right there. And also because just this building is just this big, large building, people are going to be naturally curious as far as that goes. And also times because, I mean, people just really don't quite understand. A lot of times, I mean, unless, say, they are a Mason themselves or they have a Mason within their family, they don't always quite understand about who we are and what we do. And that's why we do the public tours. That's why we have public relations to kind of dispel some of the myths and just give a glimpse of our world right here.
Do you think part of why people are so curious is because of the amount of symbolism that y'all use? I mean, there is so... It's almost like another language.
Oh, yeah. This is a very detail-oriented building that's absolutely rife with symbolism. I mean, you see that in various forms and guises all throughout the building. In fact, one of them is right out here underneath the cross. So the cross, I've only got it turned up about a quarter of the way. If I had it up all the way, you could see it from space. So there's 408 bulbs in this cross. Underneath the cross is about as center to the building as you can get. It's not an exact center, but it's about as close as you're going to get.
Up and down, left and right?
Yep. And the idea behind that, since the cross is at the center of the building, spirituality should be at the heart of every Freemason.
And that cross Rob was talking about was in the chapel. It's just one of those stunning pieces where the architecture itself is gorgeous, but then you look at individual compartmental things, just pieces that are amazingly gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. You can hear it in our walkthrough, the different things that you and I are drawn to. I'm saying, oh, my gosh, look at that. And going, what about the cross? Like, we're looking all over, and both of us were noticing different things at the same time, and there's just so much to see.
Now, normally we wouldn't wait so long to get to this part. You know, the Spooky J series is what it is. But again, we were going to do this story justice. We couldn't just go to the juicy rumor haunted element of it, right? We always want to know when we go to any place we've gone, whether it was Eloise or Orson Starr or whatever it is, the story behind the building, the place, the people, and then we'll get into the other stuff. You know, things usually make a lot more sense that way. So, is the Masonic haunted?
What myths do you encounter the most? I mean, you give a lot of tours. People ask a lot of questions.
Well, this time of year in particular, just getting close to Halloween, we have a lot of that going on. Some of these older myths that kind of got given new life by the internet. One of the most persistent ones is that the architect George Mason went broke during the Depression and committed suicide by leaping to his death from the roof. That did not happen. George Mason died in 1948 at the age of 91 from natural causes, but that's something that still kind of pops up from time to time.
That one is so easily disproven because he lived and you can prove that he was not dead.
It was the wrong building and the wrong architect and the wrong method of death. It was actually Paul Camper, who was the son of Louis Camper, the same guy that did the book tower. He actually did go broke during the Depression. He built the Hotel Detroiter, which is gone now. It was a building in Brush Park. He shot himself in Royal Oak. And so I think that over time, like through the kind of like, you know, misinterpretation, kind of like a 100-year-old game of telephone, people kind of attached it to our building. Yeah. So,
and then there was, I read one more too about, I think they called him the Eternal Member. There must be a door that goes to the roof, and it's said to lock and unlock the door at times.
Yeah. I have personally not seen or experienced anything. That's not to discount anyone who has, but I personally have not. Some of the things that have kind of been said over the years is that there's, in the building's early years, we had a doorman. So sometimes people will say they see like a figure in red outside the building. Sometimes people will say they kind of see like something out of the corner of their eye, or they experience cold points in some of the rooms. A lot of it is kind of has a scientific explanation, because sometimes, I mean, in the winter, doors will contract, in the summer, they'll swell. So that's why you kind of hear like certain noises and
some of the rooms. We have many, many, many doors throughout this building, so sometimes one gets open, just kind of just shuts on its own eventually. The building does have cold points in certain spots as well. A lot of it, too, is just kind of people's perceptions, too. It's just how you approach a building like this. It kind of interprets how you feel within it. I mean, if you feel as though that you're going to be uncomfortable in this building and you kind of carry in that way, then you're probably going to be uncomfortable.
People I know would make this up, say, I mean, look, you know, I've kind of felt certain weight in certain rooms. I mean, sometimes I've seen things I can't quite explain. I mean, it often has a scientific explanation, but, you know, every once in a while, I mean, there might, you know, so it's just like with anything else. My personal take on it is that I don't think the building, from in terms of like a paranormal perspective, is haunted per se. I do think the building has like a living energy to it. And I think that's what a lot of folks experience sometimes. Like, you know, sometimes you walk into a building or a room, you kind of feel like you're being welcomed, or you're kind of feeling like as though you're kind of being pushed out, like you don't belong there. I think in a larger sense, that's kind of what's going on in here. So it's all a matter of like individual interpretation, like how you are, again, kind of how you approach a building or a situation. And I think that's really a lot of times what's being played. So
it's funny because you said like the neo-Gothic style is about celebrating like plants and life forms and stuff. But I think most people look at it and go, those gargoyles are a little uneasy.
Yeah, from the exterior, people have kind of said that on tours sometimes, like the building from the outside looks a little bit foreboding, like a little bit almost like kind of standoffish, but it was never really designed that way. I mean, it was never designed to be like a fortress or anything like that. We were never meant to be that way. I mean, it does give itself a certain air of kind of like a regalness of, you know, being a stately building and whatnot. That's kind of what they were going for. It was meant to be a big, large monument to endure the test of time. I mean, they designed
success.
And they designed from the outset, this is going to be one of the enduring iconic buildings of the people in the city of Detroit. And 100 years later, I mean, there's been some challenges, but we try to keep that as best we can.
I love what Rob said there about the way you feel. It informs so much of what happens around you or what you think is happening around you. And I'll admit it, sometimes the building itself, I don't know if it's scary, but it makes you feel a certain way because of how big it is. It feels like when you walk up, it's towering over you, right? Like it just feels like in a Disney cartoon where everything gets dark and you get really small. I think it's really big. But I know that's not the intent, but that neo-Gothic style, I think it's a big part of why people feel that way.
Well, yeah, and it's just a massive building. So standing next to it, I mean, you're looking up at it and it can be, you know, a little bit, I don't want to say daunting, it's huge, it's overpowering. And, you know, there's quite a bit to be said about, I've done a lot of research online, and when it comes to some of these other places that we've talked about in the past, some of the other podcasts that we've done, it's pretty easy to come across the common refrain of stories of why this place is haunted, why that place is haunted. The Masonic Temple doesn't have that. And the one story that people do reference quite a bit is actually not true at all. We talked about that as well. So what I was able to find, people's experiences, a lot of them posted on places like Reddit, it was all based on feeling, just like we were saying. It was all based on, right. I was there for a show, I was there for this or that, I got a weird vibe in this one room, I felt this certain way. So again, it was all kind of like individual interpretation. And there was people who had common experiences, but there wasn't anything that was super solid, like everybody saw this one type of figure in this one place or whatnot.
Right, when we were in the Whitney, it was David Whitney moving the tea set. Nowhere else, David Whitney, the tea set. When we were at the Caju, it was the man crossing the street. It was the grandmother at the table. There was no scattershot of, well, one person saw this, one person saw that. And that is the way this is here. And I find that to be very interesting. I do, because again, people, when they talk about haunted places, or if it's Colonel Norris at the 2-way Inn, right, they can relate to a common experience. And so without being able to relate to the common experience, it's interesting that people still have the common feeling.
Yeah, the common experience is vibe, which is so abstract. It's true. And that's a great title for something. I don't know. We'll save that for later. But there's no specific, you know, at the 2-way Inn, for example, again, like you said, Colonel Norris, there were multiple people that reported seeing the same thing, or the little boy that comes out of the back room.
And you can explain why. Yeah, he would have been there, right?
Exactly.
We told that story.
There doesn't seem to be, from what I've seen anywhere online, this sort of common story or common figure or things like that. And I think that was maybe part of the reason why, you know, when I looked up the original story of why people thought that it was haunted here, and that ended up being a myth, and that got busted very quickly, it was kind of like, well, we don't necessarily feel like we have something to hang our hat on here.
Right.
But we still always wanted to tackle this story. And I think that what Rob had said to us previously about it sort of being more based on energy than any kind of like specific haunting,
yeah,
kind of rings true for sure. And we can't discount anybody's specific experiences. But I mean, there is a ton of energy in this building, and that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to jump back into the curiosity thing, Because I do get it. There was something else that we didn't get to see, but Rob described it in great detail in the chapel, but it sounded wild.
What's behind the curtain?
So behind the curtain, this room was specifically built for the commandery. The commandery has a lot of theatrical elements to it. There's kind of a knighting ceremony that takes place in that regards. So there was a lot of stage apparatus built into this particular room right here. So underneath here, here we go. Underneath us, down about a story and a half, is an elaborate stage operation with levers and pulleys and gears.
Feel it.
Yeah. This part right here would actually tilt upwards right here, and there are very large mirrors facing each other on 45 degree angles with paper mache figures that actually have a lot of elements for the commandery ceremony. So this is actually built right here for that purpose.
Is it still a thing?
Still a thing. It's used sparingly because, again, a lot of the parts are still original. We don't want to use it too often. Yeah. The figures are paper mache, so we don't want to risk damage to them. So
that must be a sight.
Again, that kind of stuff, nobody will ever make it again, and you'll never see it anywhere else. Yeah. I think that's amazing.
Absolutely.
I do think it's important that while the building was designed for the Masons, that we're in Masonic Room number 5 right now, but the intent of the building was always to have space for public use.
This is our crystal ballroom level right here. This is an area designed more for public use and less for Masonic use. It does get a few Masonic applications, but this area was designed for public use. They realized back in the 1920s, when there were still 63,000 Masons in the city of Detroit using this building, back when Detroit had the fifth highest population in the country, the city was doing very well economically, it was a boom town. They realized that Masonic use alone would not be sufficient to maintain a building of this size, of this magnitude, so they had to have some non-Masonic, more public usages for the building, primarily for revenue, but also because they wanted this to be a center for civic life, for community life as well. They wanted to share this building with the people of Detroit.
That's something I didn't really know. I wasn't sure because I actually asked you, Rob. I remember we were backstage in one of the two venues. Like, do you think that they would have, you know, anticipated like Grismas happening here? And Rob's answer was great, which is that, you know, not in its form, because who could have known? Who could have known?
Who could have predicted Christmas or Grizz?
But they did intend for shows to happen there. You know, back then, I'm sure it was mostly theater, but also I'm sure music. And so, of course, inevitably, things were going to evolve through the decades, and they have. And there's, it's still being used for public use, just like it was always intended to be.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because this part didn't make the tape. And I want to point it out, because it's such a great contrast. Like, you think about beautiful theater and then Fago Rain from the Insane Clown Posse. But Rob said this a lot, with adaptive reuse of the building. That's how places like this survive. A place of this size could not go on doing the things it was doing 100 years ago. And so in the drill hall, instead of having a drill right now, what are they doing? They're practicing roller derby, because that's what Detroit roller derby is.
And which is awesome, by
the
way.
It is awesome. And they have tenants on some of the upper floors, a law firm, whatever, things like that. And so it's like the building becomes even more integrated into the fabric of the community, because now there are more things happening here, right? And I think that that was certainly intentional, and you can feel it.
I mean, adapt or get left behind, right? I mean, that's kind of the way we see things go, and we watch that happen as technology progresses. We watch that happen as, you know, big buildings that were intended for one use, and eventually, if they're not being used for what they were intended to, I mean, they're going to be condemned eventually if they're not bringing in revenue. So it's wonderful that it's continued to be used and that it's here to stay here in the Cass Corridor.
When it comes to the takeaway for me, and I'll keep in line with the Spooky J theme, at least part of it is, you know, is the Masonic haunted? I don't know. I don't think anybody can answer that as a broad-based blanket statement. I didn't see anything. I didn't feel anything. But I do believe a building like this would capture the energy of the many thousands of people that pass through, right? And one of the things we learned early on doing this series was that limestone's a big attractor of energy, right? And this building is, there's a lot of limestone here. But also, it's the experience that people have and the place it has in their lives. And you can talk about spirits or whatever, but you can also see it in what Jack White did. Right? That's why he did what he did, because it meant so much to his mom and the rest of his family. And so, you know, I get, like, in the two-way, why, if that's the way it works, why people wouldn't want to leave, even after they were dead.
You know, we say energy, but another word for that might be emotion. You know, it's filled with emotion. It's filled with the camaraderie of the Masons. It's filled with the emotion of people coming to see live music here, which is one of the most powerful things that you can see. You know, it's
weddings, love.
Weddings and different events and history and even the roller derby. I mean, there's all kinds of emotion that's happening in this building literally right now, all the time. And I think there's a certain reverence for that. And I do think that that makes a lot of sense. We can't ever answer the question, no matter where we go, is this place haunted?
I think we've given up trying. I don't think that's what we're after anymore. No. At first, I think we were, and I think a long time ago that went away.
I mean, it evolved into more of a great way to tell some of Detroit's most interesting history.
Through the lens.
Right. And a lot of these places that we've focused on over the years have been some of Detroit's most historic. And so inevitably, of course, there's going to be stories tied to these places because they've been around for so long. I mean, it's just been a great entryway for us to be able to go behind the scenes on these amazing places that make Detroit the city that it is. And we're really lucky to be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, and just on our way out the door here, I think that's the way that this ends for us is like, thank God we're able to do this, that this building didn't get the hammer like so many did throughout the last 100 years. I mean, people talk about the last 20 years, forget it. They've been doing this in Detroit forever, tearing buildings down. Some didn't last 10 years in the early 1900s. I'm just so thankful that whether it was Jack White or whether it's going to work out anyway, doesn't matter. I'm glad that this is still here. This is what makes Detroit, Detroit, and things like this are so important. You can't
replace
them.
I mean, totally. And if I can just say too, since Rob's sitting here with us, it's also people like you, Rob, and people that have shown us around all these places over the years and have been so generous with their time, availability to show us and tell us the stories that we otherwise wouldn't have known and also, frankly, can't get on the internet. You can't find these places online as far as like the detail that you're giving to us. You can't find that on Wikipedia. You can't find that on any kind of historic website. It doesn't exist.
No, I mean, we got it walking around here with Rob. We got it sitting at the bar with Mary at the two-way, right? We got it going up and down the floors of the Whitney. We got it through all of Eloise, right? And these are things that we couldn't have done alone. There's no self-guided tour for stuff like that. These kinds of things are so important. And to be able to continue to tell the story, and I think to do it in a way that's more grounded in reality as opposed to, I love Reddit, you know that, but sometimes those Reddit threads get a little off track.
We love to be able to share our experience with people and hopefully have people walk away having learned something, because we always do, and then hopefully go and check it out for themselves. I mean, that's really the goal in all the places that we've gone to and all the folks that we've dealt with and worked with. We hope that people can share in this with us as they listen, but also go see it in person. And I think that that's a huge part of it as well.
Yeah, come take the tour. It's worth your time.
Learn Detroit history.
Today's big thanks go out to Rob Moore for not only the tour, but also for setting up this recording, sitting in this beautiful room, Masonic Number 5. Also, thanks to Gary Graff, as always, for his expertise. This story was made possible by the entire WWJ digital team. Check out WWJNewsRadio.com for the latest local news 24/7. And of course, could not have done this without Annie Scarmazzino. I'm Zach Clark.
And I'm Annie Scarmazzino.
And this is The Daily J. Thanks for listening.
It's Halloween.